In this episode of The Business Show, Corky Kooiman, director at Denker Capital, the guru of financial services investing in South Africa, will give us his latest views on what's happening in the sector. And man, is it busy. Good to be with you, Corky. We'll get on to the international stuff because there's lots going on there which is affecting international interest rates and indeed will affect us too. But here locally, it's almost musical chairs at the major banking institutions. I know people love to know about the people and the executives, but when you see a move of executives from Absa to Nedbank, and then a move of executives from Standard Bank to Absa, almost filling that gap because the CEO gets appointed, in the case of Standard Bank, Kenny Fittler moving across to Absa, and he brings his guys along. I suppose that's par for the course. But you, as the custodian of billions of dollars in investments on behalf of your clients, does this strike you with some kind of disquiet when you are invested in those companies and you've suddenly got this wholesale change of management at the top?
Yeah, so I mean, the concern would more be at on Standard Bank level, but their bench is just so deep, and Sim Tshabalala has just done so well, so that he could almost afford to lose a few players off his bench. And in one way, you could say, well, the positive is there's a lot of people, on that second, third level who are getting excited, who the opportunities for them. And as you recall, Sim and Arno announced their retirement to also create space for people below them. So it's always a loss when you lose people. The quality of Kenny and now already two senior execs below them, but Standard Bank have got a good bench. So on Absa, look, the valuation at 1x book for a return on capital of make it 15%, 16%, it shows you, and we know the reasons that the market's very concerned about the franchise, and that's due to the revolving chair of CEOs for, what is it now, eight years almost, where you've had almost a CEO per year, and internal dissension. There's been a lot of, the press as well, reports about internally things not being good. So you needed people to come from the outside. And Kenny obviously walked in there and saw, and I'm sure he did his homework beforehand, that the culture needs to be fixed. And he brought a few guys in from the top who he knows and he respects, and he can just get them going. So the risk always of a strategy like that is, does the organization accept the new appointments, or is there a silent revolt against them and saying, because they want to go and change things? Yeah, it depends on the leadership. If the leadership convinces everybody that, and I'm sure within Absa, there's a lot of realization that things have got to change. So if the leadership, the new leadership, convinces them, guys, we're all in this together, this is where we want to go, this is where we can go, and the appointments have been good, they bring knowledge, they bring insight, and if you're junior, you should actually welcome that and say, yes, this is good, this is good for the bank, we can go, we can grow again, we can be proud again, and restore the Absa brand to what it was. So for Absa, a bit of uncertainty still while the change is happening. But the appointments have been good, and where they are is where they indeed there were shortages, and so I'm not too worried about it. But it is interesting the moves between the banks. It happens everywhere, but suddenly in South Africa it's happening in a big way.
Yeah, and as you say, suddenly in South Africa, if you go back a few years, it would have been impossible for a chief executive of Old Mutual to become chief executive of Sanlam. It just wouldn't have happened. I mean, those are companies, you know both of them very well, and yet that's exactly what's happened now. And similarly in banking, if I suppose in banking is a little more fluid, but why would the people at Absa, that concrete level, the antibodies of the organization. Why would they say this time will be different? What is Kenny going to be bringing, Kenny Fittler bringing, that perhaps they hadn't had in the past?
Well, I think three things. One, he comes from the outside. So there are no allegiances, there's no favoritism, there's no, you know, I mean, looking back, Arie Rautenbach, who I regarded highly, but Arie's weakness was that he came out of retail. And that shapes you and that forms you and you, you know, so, and there was always in suspicion when he does something, is he just favoring retail? Is he pushing retail more? Is it, so also does he, but Kenny comes from outside. So I think that's number one. Two, he's done it. He's got a good track record. He's a strong individual. So, but three, I think also inside Absa, there's a realization and they can see it in the share price themselves that, you know, we need to change. We're losing market share. They've actually been losing market share continuously. You know, and if you're in banking and you even mid-lower level, executive level, this concerns you because your incentives should also be tied to your share price. And you would want that to turn.
So would you be buying the shares in anticipation that this time is different?
So there's always a few things you bear in mind there. One is obviously the alternative. So yeah, like Nedbank is just trading actually, funny enough, on exactly the same level, 1.01 price to net asset value, tangible net asset value.
Explain what that means, Corky. Just explain that, if you would.
So we tend to not value banks or insurers on a PE basis because the earnings are too volatile. So you tend to look at the net asset value, the tangible net asset value, which basically means the shareholders' capital. And like a bond or a house, you're looking at what the return that you can generate on that house, rental income on the what you paid for the house or paying for the house, or if you're buying a government bond, you can get, let's say, 8% now. So for a bank, you obviously would expect that 8% plus the risk-free interest rate plus a margin of safety. And so at the moment, you're getting for both of them, the return on capital on that capital is about 15%. So your return on that tangible NAV is 15%. And the share price is trading at the same price as that tangible NAV. So what we call the price to net asset value is one, which in fact 1.01 on today's price. So, so you're getting a 15% return on capital. And you're paying book value for that, that's not bad. And then remember, both of them are, and that goes for the sector, we're in a very, very tough environment. The consumer's under pressure. There is no growth. And on the consumer side, we'll talk about that later, the growth. But so bad debts are at risk of rising on the consumer side again, unless we get interest rate cuts. So, but going forward, one is hoping, and it looks as if there are a lot of green shoots again that things could turn, that growth does pick up, economic growth, loan growth picks up, and then your returns on capital will increase. So you're getting a franchise, a business that's trading at book value, which for return on capital of 15% is fairly low. And the net asset value, that book value will grow. And you're getting, of that return on capital, I'm talking about 15%, you're getting almost half of that out in a dividend. So you're getting cash. And it comes every quarter, every 6 months. Nedbank paid a big divvy, I think, yesterday. So you know, you're getting quite a good cash dividend as well. And now it's, you can just sit and wait. Yeah, you can sit and wait for Kenny to do the hard work. You don't have to go. If you buy a property, you've got to go and check the geyser. You've got to go and check, is the tenant the right? Are you getting your rental income? Yeah, you can just sit and the dividend check comes into your bank every 6 months or every 3 months, and Kenny's doing the hard work for you. And Jason, provided, bank, and you're now at Old Mutual.
Provided Kenny and Jason do the hard work. But just going back there, and thank you for unpacking that for us. People who often know about buying property, say, and they'll buy a property and then they get the rental, and if they get a 10% rental return in a year, they think, well, that's pretty good. What we're talking about here is the bank is actually making you 15%. So you're buying Absa, and you have got a very strong likelihood that the capital value will improve, as one would hope with property in good markets. So thanks for unpacking that. Just moving on to Nedbank now. Jason Quinn's been there for a while. Are the signs that he's worth that investment at getting a 15% return? Is he showing anything from his new leadership style and indeed the people he's brought in?
Yeah, so he's made the first big move, and it's a brave move, is to sell the stake in their African operations, there where they had a 22% stake in Ecobank, which was done, 8 to 10 years ago by Mike Brown. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, Africa was the growth area of the world. Everybody was very excited, big population, low, very young population. And, you know, for the past 20 years, every year we hear Africa is where the growth is going to be. But politically, Africa just doesn't sort itself out. But, okay, so Nedbank wanted to participate in that. And I think at that stage, it made sense to go into Africa. They prayed too much for it, but that was mostly part of the excitement of Africa. But they didn't get the benefits they really thought they would. It's always different if you involved yourself and you own it than when you're sitting on the side and you have a few boards on the director's board. So it wasn't going well, and it's been a drag. And so Jason made the wise decision, let's cut it. And obviously didn't make that on his own, but he made this. And I think that's a big decision. So now the next challenge is you're sitting suddenly with quite a bit of capital that you receive from that. Well, if the sale obviously is still going to happen, it's still going to get the cash, but the decision's been made. And what do you do with it? But you have, of the four banks, excluding then Investec, you've got the lowest African exposure, very little exposure to Africa, and that's just really the SADC countries. So what do you do there? And so far he's announced more they want to do what First Rand have always been doing, also a bit of briefcase banking. So you fly out for deals and you set up a correspondent network. And then when there's a transaction that could happen, you fly out a few guys, good guys, heavy hitters who can make decisions, to go negotiate and see. So you keep your cost base lower and you build up a network. And that's really what they're going to try and do. At the same time, they then bought a stake in a fintech player, which is really where the challenge is going to be in future for banks. Yeah, just to increasingly be more user-friendly to your SMEs and your clients. So the big battle in South Africa at the moment it's worldwide, is on what we call the SME space, small, medium enterprises. Traditionally, because of all the complexities of and the risks of lending to a small, medium enterprise, banks have always stood back from that. But technology has made it so much easier to give them good service. And that's where a lot of the battle is going. And so Nedbank have done a purchase, and it looks like a good one, early days, but that's more where they want to focus. So Jason has certainly not been sitting still. The last results also still reflects a bit where the economy is. But yeah, now I think it will grow. But you need South Africa to grow for the banks to really do well.
But it's like
maybe one other point, Alec, mm-hmm. while we're on that, it is interesting that the part of the South African banks that is growing is Africa. So the growth in returns and the profitability growth is coming largely out of Africa. And that's where Nedbank just standing at the back of the queue and Standard Bank in the front of the queue.
Just, I want to bring in something from mining. Harmony bought a copper player in Australia and made it dreadful. It was a terrible investment. They've now gone back and bought another copper player for another $1 billion, which hopefully is a much better investment. Certainly talking to Peter Major, he says he thinks this time around they could be okay. He still thinks that it's expensive, but they could be okay, whereas the first one, he said, was just dumb. This time, we're looking at Nedbank going in, buying 35% of Ecobank. It clearly hasn't worked out. Might it be that they've got the experience, they got the bruises, they've paid the school fees, that Jason Quinn's got something else lined up, i.e. to still get involved in a market which clearly is the one that is delivering the goods for the South African banks, but this time not just sit there with a minority share, but own at least 50% of it. Could that be part of his strategy?
I'm sure when they sit around the table and he himself, I don't know if he said in his study, got a map there, you know, and where he puts on strategies and, you know, what he would like to do. But when they sit around the table, it is one of the options. It must be. And I'm sure, you know, they've got people looking out there for them for possible opportunities. Now, the way banking has evolved with more and more pressure from the regulators on capital and on risk, you're still seeing an ongoing move from big international players selling their local entities. I mean, FirstRand bought the HSBC business, and there are units everywhere for sale, and even the French banks there. And the French banks are even more under pressure also because of what's happening in France, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a continuous sale of units that the board sits and say, you know, this is just never going to grow with us being in charge. It's suboptimal, let's sell. So I'm sure they're looking at that. But I would assume in southern part of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, there can't be that much left. Although there is, I actually had the privilege of speaking to a group of Malawian bankers the other day. And it was interesting. There's a, they were mentioned name. It's a very, very good little bank. I was very impressed with what they are doing. And so theoretically, they could be up for sale. But okay, problems Malawi, low growth. But so there will be opportunities. I'm sure they're looking.
It's so interesting when you put it into context like that. And we can then follow the movements as they happen from here. Still talking about people. Capitec, Gerry Fourie, one of the original guys, one of the founders, he's now stepping aside. What's it looking like there with the succession plans? And I think it's also important that you dwell a little on its succession plans. FirstRand seem to have got it right always. Standard Bank, as you say, have got a deep bench, so Sim's not really going to be stressing too much. Although Kenny Fittler, wasn't he tipped to take over at one point? So it might be a bit of a disappointment there. But Capitec, where are they going with their new CEO?
You know, when the announcement came that Gerry is stepping down, I sent him a mail and said, Gerry, before you go, I'd like to still have a good chat. And he said, okay, come across. And I had a wonderful hour with him. But firstly, he's stepping back, but not stepping away. it was fascinating just talking to him again, just now, not worrying about next quarter's earnings or, you know, just focusing on what he's done, what he's been trying to do, where the bank is. Few people realize the immense pressure a CEO of any organization, but more so a bank because it's in the public face, is under. You know, the whole time, you've got a staff of, what is it? What is his staff now? Must be already be 30,000 or something, but a big staff. You've got, you know, a lot of businesses at the same time. Something goes wrong. You're always in the firing line. And so he said he just wants to step back for a while, take it easy. But he's going to, for the first year, he's very involved, coaching, being available also to the CEO. And then most probably in the years to come, we'll see how that goes, how he gets involved. The international side, we can talk about that just now. It's very exciting, potentially, where they're going. They've got, is it Henk Lawrence, who's now taking that as a project for a year, who's the last remaining senior guy from that original crop of guys. So I'm sure Gerry will talk a lot to him and be involved there. But he said the most important thing, I just want to step back for a while. I just want to also smell some roses, enjoy what I'm doing, and then come back still at Capitec, maybe as a director on the board. So he will still be there, and that's important, his guidance and wisdom. But at the same time, you need the new CEO to step in and be his own man. And it's not well known that he's been a Capitec, the new CEO has been a Capitec man for 20 years, I think. He worked for Gerry as an analyst at the beginning. He, in between, took time off. Well, at that stage, he thought he was going to do it for a longer time. It wasn't part of planning, but he worked in Nigeria for a few years, also at a financial institution, immensely good experience to like be also involved, like Capitec was, in the lower level income side. Just come back, worked 4 years now directly under Gerry, being in charge of retail. So now I'm not concerned about the quality. And so the main thing I always challenged Gerry on is, as you grow, the one thing that has really sets Capitec aside, and it's amazing, go and read just on their website again, their last, all their presentations, it's all about the culture. Culture of simplicity, client centricity. It's really foremost in what they do. Everything is about the client. So, and quick decision making, ability to move. So, as the organization grows, I keep on asking, how do you preserve that culture? Because, as you know, the bigger organization gets, the more the top leadership become afraid of giving responsibility down the line, because of the risk to brand. But what they've done very well is, and various via incentives, via all the way the business works, is keeping decision-making as low down as possible and everybody being responsible. So it's responsibility and accountability. That is the key thing all the way down, where people can act and can move quickly. So I hope that works for them, and I think it will. So it's a very strong culture in the whole organization where I remember, you know, first round, the guys always used to say to me, even Paul Harris and the guys, the culture in our organization is such that if anybody walks in the corridor and there's a piece of paper lying on the floor, they'll pick it up because it's our business. We don't want paper on the floor. You know, everybody feels responsible for how the business looks. And so Capitec, a great business, really doing well. The insurance side is now coming through very strongly, as well on the SME, the small business side, coming strongly. Just on the whole data thing now. And then the rest of the world, those six franchises they've got now is very exciting. They're now starting, now that they've got control, they're starting the exercise of really testing each market, as they did with Capitec. You'll recall, even Michiel Leroux and Rian Stassen used to go and walk the townships and go and see what the people want. Where are the people? Remember, traditionally, banks were in the city center. Capitec sorted all the people at the taxi ranks. You open a branch at the taxi rank. So they're doing that in Mexico. They've been in the small villages talking to people. What are the needs? And then they're going to evolve each of those franchises based on the Capitec model, but focused on, you know, the local needs. Now, that's a 10-year project. The Capitec is so big, those things. But in 10 years' time, if those things grow as they intend to, it could be very exciting.
Why have they gone to Mexico rather than elsewhere on this continent?
That's a very good question. I've got the privilege of occasionally speaking to Simon Oliver, who built Tinkoff Bank. They're looking as well, this part in Uzbekistan now for TBC, and they're also looking, where can we else grow in the world with this technology we have in Capitec? And by the way, Mexico and Brazil have been the two areas in the world where the large banks became very oligopolistic, or it's a big word, but became too strong and fat cat, especially in Brazil, where Itaú and Bradesco were just so big, they became fat and lazy. And it's interesting, the two countries where the so-called fintechs, you know, the younger challengers have had the most success. A new bank, the fastest growing bank in the world, started in Brazil and in, I think, 10 years got to 100 million clients. Now, basically, because the large banks had become too inertia, couldn't react quickly enough. And remember, when you're a large commercial bank, you make a lot of money out of corporate banking, big deals. And so that consumer segment's always sitting there on the side. In Capitec's case, Mexico was just the business they bought a stake in. It's also about 10 years ago. It was then called, unfortunate name of Cream Finance. That's now changed, but they had, the founders of Cream Finance had operations in six different countries, Denmark, Georgia, actually at that stage was one of the Baltics, But for some reason, they also bought a stake in something, or they started something in Mexico. So Capitec inherited that. But having inherited that, they like Mexico. I must say, we also very impressed with we've got investments in Mexico as well. So it is at the moment a bit volatile with Trump, with tariffs, and with, you know, the tussle between China and, but Mexico potentially has a lot of potential.
Such an interesting story that you've outlined for us there. Just coming back home though with Capitec, are they making much progress in attacking that SME market with the old Mercantile, which is now Capitec Business Bank?
Yeah, no, it's been, it was a bit slow in the takeoff, which, by the way, is a Capitec style. You know, Rian Stassen as well, for years, just worked on the foundation, slow moves, making sure that what you do is solid foundation. But the business bank is doing very well. The growth numbers are also in the 20-30%, taking market share from, unfortunately, APSA as well, because APSA has just been on the back foot there the whole time. Also from Standard Bank, but doing very well.
Okay, well, let's move internationally now. You had Jackson Hole, and maybe explain what Jackson Hole is and why it's so important and why it might affect our pockets and the interest rates in this country.
Yeah, so Jackson Hole essentially is where the financial leaders of the world or the decision makers gather once a year. It's, am I right, Alec, it's in Texas, if I'm not mistaken. It's quite far.
Wyoming, anyway, somewhere up there,
Wyoming,
in America.
But they actually get away from the original idea was many years ago, was to get away from the crowd and just sit there for a few days. And unfortunately, initially, it was a quiet thing, but obviously the public get to know and the press want to know and the decisions are made. And so no decisions are made, but it's a think tank. And so the big thing for what you're referring to is what came out is that Jay Powell, who is the chairman at the moment still of the Federal Reserve Bank, in other words, the Central Bank or Reserve Bank of America, indicated that for the first time, the underlying growth and unemployment numbers, the data they see, is starting to indicate that the economy, the U.S. economy, is slowing down. More important, inflation is starting to come down, because that was the key. While he was reluctant to lower interest rates in America because of the inflationary pressures, and remember, Trump's tariff policy increased the cost of goods, so that's inflationary pressure. And so he indicated that what they're seeing so far is we could see an interest rate cut this month. And then obviously the markets like that, because lower interest rates, depending on the reason for the lower interest rate, but generally lower interest rates is good for markets, because just think of a house. If you're buying a house for $1 million and you're paying 10%, or you're paying 9%, you pay 9% on the mortgage, you can afford a bigger house. And so what happens when interest rates come down? Prices of assets tend to rise, of all assets. And so the markets like that. The feeling is that because of the Fed has held interest rates so high so long, that we could see 2 to 3 to 4 cuts, interest rate cuts in the US. And that's important to us because the rest of the world uses the US interest rates as almost, whether you like it or not, that's the benchmark, because it's always been the risk-free interest rate. So if US interest rates, let's say at 4, we can't afford to sit at 2, because money will move from South Africa to so you've always got to be a fair bit above US interest rates to ensure you keep attracting capital to make up for the risk of South Africa or any other country for that matter. So US interest rates going lower is important for emerging markets. It releases capital, or it makes it more attractive to go to emerging markets in theory, and also for financial assets. But
Donald Trump has been pushing for lower interest rates for a while, and hence this fight between him and Jay Powell. But would Lesetse Ganyago have been at that meeting at Jackson Hole, our Reserve Bank
chairman? I don't know. I'm sure he has the stature that he would have been invited.
So he would presumably bring back the sentiments from there, which may then influence the way that he influences our own Monetary Policy Committee, and we might see lower interest rates. Is that possible? Is it on the cards here?
Lower interest rates. I think where our growth rate is, we certainly should be lowering interest rates because there's no growth at the moment. And like in Brazil, where they've got the same problem, and Lissette will be saying to the government, it's your policies that are keeping growth rate low and inflation high. You know, just what's happened with NERSA and Eskom. It's going to be inflationary. The higher electricity costs feeds through to everything, keeps inflation high. So it doesn't help he lowers interest rates when he doesn't have support, fiscal support from government that makes growth and lower inflation. So yeah, his mandate is to ensure the stability of the currency, which is very important, and to keep inflation, a low inflation environment. So the tussle with him and the Treasury at the moment is the Reserve Bank wants the inflation target that they set even lower. And inflation is generally, you need some inflation for growth, but generally it's good for the wealthy because the wealthy have assets. You've got a house, you've got shares. Inflationary pressures normally push up the prices of that. It's the poor that suffer under inflation because their wages always rise slow and then the cost of transport, the cost of food. And so he's really actually, it's a policy trying to help the poor. And so it's like a child. You punish him because it's good for him, but he's keeping interest rates high to get inflation down. And that's the pressure. And that's really what Jay Powell is doing in the US as well, making sure that the inflationary pressures have abated. Because the worst thing you want to do as a central bank governor is to, lower interest rates while inflationary pressures haven't abated. And then inflation picks up. And you've got to hike interest rates again. And then you get a lot of volatility and uncertainty.
If only our politicians, our lawmakers would be a little more understanding and a little more, have better insight into all of these issues. It would make such a difference when it comes to the way that the country goes forward. But it's not just here. We're seeing big problems happening in Europe in particular. Do you want to unpack that for us? Because we've got, on the one hand, we've got America who want to pull interest rates down. And in Europe, they're saying, no, we're going to hold interest rates here. And what you see in France and in the UK could be added to it, is pretty concerning for the people there and for us, because these are our trading partners, and this is the world economy that we're talking about.
Yeah, the US, France, UK is a mess, even Germany, Japan. So the tension that we're finding at the moment is that politicians think short term. So main thing a politician wants is to get elected or re-elected. And in the US case, Trump wants the economy to grow. Why? Because it makes him look good. And okay, special case. But so he's putting immense pressure on the central bank to lower interest rates. And globally, it's in most strong developed market countries and emerging markets like Indonesia, India, etc., Brazil, Mexico, where your central bank is independent. And so it makes decisions on interest rates primarily from an independent point of view, not having that pressure of a politician who's got to win the election. And so thinking longer term of what's really good for the economy. And there can be debate as to whether they get it right or wrong, but the main important thing is their independence. Trump wants to influence that and to get interest rates lower. Why? Just to suit his needs. Longer term, if he succeeds in firing or getting rid of Jay Powell, and he's now trying to fire Lisa Cook, who is one of the higher interest rates proponents, and he wants to replace the people on the Fed with Trump loyalists who will be puppets of him and just lower interest rates. I mean, that's in broad, it's more difficult for him to get that done, but that's where he's wanting to go. It will be a disaster for America because that means that, sure, you get growth for like 2 years, but then you're going to get strong inflationary pressures. And now we get to the big issue that's affecting all the countries in the world is that debt levels, your debt as a percentage of your gross domestic product, or call it the size of your economy, so what your economy is and your debt relative to that, as have never been that high globally. It's the same if I buy a house and the house is worth $1 million and I fund it with $500,000, that's fine. But if I get a loan of $1.2 million for a house of $1 million, I'm going to be in trouble because, you know, the house value, and then obviously more payments become important. Better example for me would have been to use the size of the bond payment relative to my salary. So if your size of your bond payment becomes bigger and bigger as a percentage of a salary, it means there's so much less you can spend on your children's schooling. Now, exactly the same with the governments. The governments have gotten themselves into a position, and there are all reasons for that, where the debt levels have become so high in South Africa as well, that the interest payments are really hurting the economy. So you can't grow anymore because you're paying too much on and the fear is then that governments either do what they call financial repression. So in other words, you force your pension funds or your banks to take your debt at a lower interest rate. but then there's a lekker oplossing. It works for a while. But then who suffers? Yeah, those pensioners. Because remember, in their pension funds, they get a lower interest rate, which affects them in 10, 15 years when they retire. And so that scenario, global high debt levels, low growth, rising interest rates, is making global investors very worried, and especially Trump now pushing for to remove the independence of the central bank. That catches on, you're going to go into a higher inflation world. And that's why globally, the 10 and especially the 30-year long bond yield. So it's paper that governments issue with a 10-year maturity or 30-year maturity or 20-year have been rising steadily, reflecting the concerns of global investors as to, you know, the ability or the risk premium they want on the government's debt. Japan's debt 30-year premium is very high. The UK has been almost every day, UK 10-year, 30-year papers is getting higher. Means as a bond investor, you're losing money because the value of the bond falls. But it all reflects the concerns of investors. Okay, so now maybe just to bring it all to one point. So short-term interest rates going lower is good for assets because the short-term financing costs makes it more affordable, and obviously it helps the economy. But if you've got high long-term rates, that's not good for markets because in the end, long-term assets are priced off the long-term rates. Because if you want a mortgage, you have to use the long-term rate. So these higher long-term rates are signaling concern of markets of where economies like the UK and France are now the poster children, the bad poster children of an economy that is in a mess, is not growing, it's overregulated, but the politicians are so divided and the population as well. Now, maybe to end off with this, the German Chancellor, recently elected, made a very chilling statement. He said, warning the German population that the socialist welfare state that they've become used to is not affordable anymore. So even Germany, which is financially still strong, is warning its citizens, you've just had it too good. We've been giving you too much freebies, and the source of the income with which we've always paid this, which actually was borrowing from the future debt, is running out. France already there, and that's why there's now have to be an election. I don't know how else they solve it. But again, the left and the right are so divided into what to do. The left say, tax the rich and tax the banks. Very good idea. But, you know, what do the rich do? They then flee the country. Liz Truss found that in the UK, Magda Wierzyszka is going to come back to South Africa because of the high tax rates in the UK. But so you're finding a lot of people, wealth is transportable. It's sad. You can complain about that, but it's reality. So you tax people, they move. The same, you tax the banks, it means it's less attractive for them to lend. So yeah, so you've got this huge, the population who make the decisions in a democracy haven't got the financial education to really realize what they're voting for. And that's, I think, a key of the part of the problem.
And the concern is the people they have voted into those positions got there because they promised things that are unsustainable, and you can't give those goodies away forever. Here in South Africa, we've been mortgaging the future for years, decades now, by running massive budget deficits and increasing our debt and a big social net that is there. It's small in terms of the money that people get, but in terms of what we can afford, it's unaffordable. And I guess at some point in time, all of this has to come to a very sticky end, or not.
Yep.
Is there a way out?
So, like with Mother Lit in our team, we keep arguing this the whole time. There's a lot of articles going around. You just have to Google that at the moment, long bond yields, or how does, you know. The US has been here once before in the 70s, when also that was triggered a bit by the oil price shock in the 70s. And they had a central bank governor, Arthur Burns, who didn't hike. He hiked and lowered too soon. And you had a long period of continuously increasing inflation, mirroring a lot of what's happening at the moment. In the end, you had a guy who came in, a Paul Volcker, who said, the only way you solve this problem is by having a reset. And it's painful, but at the moment, like France and UK are in that position where there is not a pain-free choice. Whatever decision you make, there's going to be pain. He chose the point of hiking interest rates then to 12.5%, 12.5% in the US, highest interest rates they've ever had, causing a big global recession. But that allowed them to reset, higher interest rates, pay off debt, a lot of restructuring. And by the way, since then, we've had this last bull market since then has been because of interest rates then continuously over 40 years could come lower to where they are now, too low. But you're going to have to go. And by the way, I'm by nature an optimistic person. So I've never been on your show being a bear. But this is the concern of markets, that you're going to go to a Paul Volcker era where someone will finally, normally what happens is Trump will lose the election, or in France, people get kicked out. But it's happened in both Argentina and Greece, where you had politicians elected who, in the end, the public trusted to actually really restore them back to basics, and which they did. Malay and Argentina went on TV and on all his shows. He had a chainsaw with him, as to signify he's going to cut all the regulation, all the red tape, all the unnecessary thing, all these things that the government has been doing, and free the economy up. And it's been working so far in Greece as well, fastest growing country in Europe at the moment. So you need that to happen. And basically, it's got to happen through the ballot box. People got to vote in a new government who will make the economy grow, create jobs again. But there's pain.
Giving us a sobering conversation today. Look forward to the next time. He is director at Denker Capital. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.